Okay, most people have managed to get a space aside. Oh, great, excellent. So for those of you who have been coming to this center for a long time, you may notice that when I give a talk, it is based on Buddhist principles, it is a Buddhist center, but I usually talk about just how we can improve our lives just by changing our attitudes. Because as much in our life we have not got the power, the ability to change, the one thing we can do a lot about is the way we look at life, the way we react to our life. And by seeing things in a different way, so that it lessens our anxiety, our irritation, our pain, and live as happy and more peaceful human beings. And the last couple of talks I was just focusing on just how we can change our attitudes towards perfection and not be try so hard to be something you're not and to improve yourselves. Too many people are trying to improve themselves and they're getting all frustrated. Actually, they get worse. The more they try to improve, the worse they get. And then we suddenly learn that, you know, who says we're not good enough? Where did that come from? And so we learn how to be at peace with ourselves. Learn how to be at peace with ourselves. Not to make ourselves perfect first and then to be at peace with yourself. Be at peace with yourself as you are now. And then the improvement happens. Then the problems get solved. It's counterintuitive to many people in the West, but it is what has worked for centuries in the East. Learn to relax and be at peace with yourself. Accept yourself as you are. And then you find that the problem gets solved. So it's all about changing the attitudes which we have towards our life. And somehow or other, somehow the Western world, and I say this as a Western-born person, has been just so into progress and development and not really recognizing just what we already have. There's a basic saying of Buddhism, which, you know, if you're going to learn any Buddhism, you don't need to learn lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of theories. You don't need to read all the books, thank goodness, because there's heaps of them. All you really need to do is understand what those books really mean. And that saying is, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. You can't even appreciate what you already have. Because you're not looking at what you already have. You're way over there wanting something more. To develop the next addition to your house. How many more rooms do you need in the house? My house has only got one room. I live in a cave. It's beautiful. It's so simple. It doesn't take long to clean it up. And even I don't need to clean it up. Someone cleans it up for me. Out of compassion for the cleaner, I only have a small room. Imagine you go home tonight and you've only got one room. And that's all you have in your house. Oh, what bliss. You don't have much to clean up. You can't have many possessions because you can't fit them in. You don't have to spend all your life saving up and paying off the debts to build these huge mansions in which you live. Look at how we live these days. You live in mansions which even kings 100 years ago would not be able to live in. They're so huge and big. Why do we do that? Because it's what everybody else does. And sometimes we need some people to say, what on earth are you doing? Can you actually look at things in a different way? Small is much more beautiful. And also, I never expected to actually go on this, but those of you who were privileged, were fortunate to be poor when you grew up. You had to share rooms with your brothers, sisters. Sometimes people say they had to share the same bed with four or five siblings. Yeah, you may not have got much sleep at night, but you sure had a lot of fun together. And you learn how to love one another. It's one of the things which, because I was poor, I spent my whole life in the same room with my brother. Only one bedroom we had to share. We didn't have private bedrooms. And those of you who have, you know, seen my brother, we love each other, we get on. Even he was a banker, I was a monk. you couldn't get sort of two more diverse careers than that. But, you know, we respect each other, love each other, you know, to this day. And I often say, why was that? Because we had to get on together. And now you give separate rooms to all your kids, huge mansions, which means that we don't learn how to get on together. We don't learn how to love. We don't learn those attitudes of life. So I always think small is incredibly beautiful. It's great for the economy, great for sort of not sort of wasting all the resources, you know, of our planet, bad for the building industry, bad for the government, bad for the GDP, but really great for human happiness. Small, close together, learning how to get on, because you have to. So changing attitudes like that is part of my life. It's being a bit rebellious, but why not? And one of the biggest attitudes which I wanted to change, you know, in my career as a monk, is just the way that we look at material stuff being really important. Things are not important. People, relationships are. Doesn't matter how much stuff you have. Look, experiences which I've had as a monk, because as a monk, I really recommend this lifestyle. If you really want to go to interesting places where you people can't go, I can go to these places because I'm a monk. You can go to see royalty, go to see, presidents. I met a couple of presidents, a couple of royalty. And you guys, how can you get to be there in those places? And you can as a monk, because it's weird. Somehow or other they think because you're religious, you must be really special. Especially if you're in politics, they need all the blessings they can get. Seriously. So that's why they sort of... And you know, one of the things which I've noticed talking to prime ministers and presidents, quite a few of them now, that one of the things which they ask you is they say, help. The problems of the world are just so tough and they've run out of solutions. Literally, they don't know what to do. And they say, we're open for any suggestions, any new ways of dealing with these things, because it's just hopeless, whether it's economy, terrorism, global warming, help. And so they're very open to people like myself, spiritual people, trying to give them some new way of looking at things which can cut through the great burdens and problems and obstacles of getting things done. So, seeing that, you get into some very interesting areas of existence, which gives me an opportunity to maybe do some stuff. As a monk, because you do live outside the box, you know, you do think outside the box. And I was very happy after the last federal election to I've been saying this for so many years, and somebody actually sent me a copy of the Melbourne Age, where something I've been saying for a long time actually appeared in a lead article about just our democracy. Democracy doesn't work. We all know that. So how can we improve it? Why do we always have to take the same old system and do it again and again and again, knowing it doesn't work? So what I was suggesting, and I was just using a little bit of reason, okay, this comes from the corporate world, but the corporate world isn't all bad. If you hold shares in a company, at their AGM, you have votes proportionate to the number of shares you hold in that company. If you hold 10% of the shares, you get 10% of the vote, which sounds fair. Your investment, your commitment to that organization will determine how many votes you get. That seems very fair. What about our democracy, our governments? Why is it that everyone has one vote each? Even though there are some people who are so old, they're going to die soon. They don't have much of a share in life. But young people, 18-year-olds, the whole life ahead of them. Maybe life expectancy, say 80 maybe, 60 years of life, should they have the same vote as an old person who's on the way out soon? Cannot we apportion, a very simple mathematical solution, can't we apportion the number of votes to your life expectancy, the amount of shares you have in life, which means young people would have a much, much larger say than the old guys who don't really give that much of a damn about global warming because they're not going to be here to face the consequences. They don't give much, well, they do care, I'm not saying they don't care, but they don't care as much about going to war because they don't have to fight. It's the young people have to fight and take the bullets and die. Wouldn't it be amazing if we could just somehow change the balance so those who have more commitment to this world, more investment, more life expectancy, have more say about how this world and the world they're going to live in is going to be run. That, I think, just that simple thing would change a lot. So I like to seeing things in a different way because this is part of my life to see things in a different way. And that was the gist of an article which somebody wrote in the Melbourne Age. I don't know if they got it from me, but it just comes up there. People think, ah, it's a stupid idea. But eventually these ideas get some traction and people realize, yeah. One of my other great ideas, our education system, kids over here in West Australia have already done the year 12s, how much stress that is. And everybody knows, just getting high grades in year 12, which is the pre-university exam, doesn't guarantee you're going to be successful in life. It's just you're good at exams. Look at me. I passed all my exams. I went to Cambridge. And look at me now. I'm broke. I've got no money. I've got a tiny house. I've got no assets, no superannuation. What a waste of time those exams were. And honestly, they were. I'd say that, okay, people argue with me. But I went to Cambridge University, hang out with Nobel laureates, people top of their field, and then I decided to become a monk. Why to become a monk? Well, I told people actually, I think in New Year's, I think because I had a relationship, she dumped me and I became a monk to forget. That's not true. I wish it was true, because that would be really romantic, that would be really cool. But then somebody said, well, it could be true, Ajahn Brahm, because you've forgotten. It's logically consistent. But no. But you became a monk, and then you were with these old monks in northeast Thailand had only gone to school for 4 years. And after a few weeks, you had to admit, you had to confess to the fact that they were much smarter than you were. They were much more intelligent. And I think, what have I been doing, working so hard? And these people are far more intelligent than I am. There's something wrong with our education system. We learn how to think. We don't know how to be still, and how to listen, and how to know. It's one of the reasons why we're in such a big problem in our life, because we listen to all these thoughts, we solve problems through thoughts, and we don't really solve the problem, we just make more problems. Thoughts are just out of control. And you know that. When you really have a big problem, a lot of anxiety, a lot of difficulty in life, what do? You think like crazy, and it makes you more mad. And you never find a solution that way. Solutions come through stillness. So this is actually what we learn, sort of as monks. We learn how to be still and let the mind see things, how we can hear things. Like thinking is like talking back at life. If ever you like live with somebody and you talk to them and they're not listening, they're listening to their thoughts, they're not listening to you. And that's like you're living with life. Life is always teaching you, giving you advice, but you never listen because you're too busy talking to yourself inside your thinking world. When you're still, it's amazing just what you understand and what you see. Somebody was asking me earlier, so you see, all of these monks in the time, you know, when I was where I grew up, and even beforehand, in the old books which I used to read, all these monks used to live in the forest, in nature. And they said their greatest teacher was nature. Because they would always be listening to nature. Much more than books, much more than experts like me, you know, in front of a microphone. They would go out there and learn it for themselves, you know, in the raw nature. Look, one example of that. Within a few days' time, there's, I don't know what it is, that recently there's a spate of deaths. There's a funeral here this afternoon, a funeral here on Wednesday, there's another funeral I have to go to on Tuesday. I don't know why people are dying, perhaps because, you know, they waited until after Christmas and New Year to get it over and done with, and then they're not going to die. You know, so they scheduled it for out of compassion for everybody else. I always say that to people, you know, that, look, I mean, don't be so selfish. Why do people die when they want to die? You should think of your friends and your relationships. Make sure it's convenient for them. I always said that during the Rains retreat, because we go on retreat for 3 months every year, the monks and the nuns, so we can have some peace and quiet, we can meditate. So I ask everybody before our rain season retreat begins of 3 months, because my rest, relaxation, please, don't die during the Rains retreat. Die beforehand, afterwards, whenever you want, but that 3 months, please. Now be respectful, don't just be selfish and die when you want to die. Of course, that's just messing around, you can't do that. But anyway, so there was a young person. That causes so much suffering for people when young people die. There's something about this, they haven't lived a full life yet. Why? Why does that happen? And have you ever got a good answer to that? The answer which I got from that, I got from a monk, an old monk, who was living in the jungle, who was one of these people who was still enough to listen to the teachings from the nature, from around us. Brilliant teachings. And I tell this every time I have to do a funeral service for someone who is young. I tell this, and many people get it. They understand. Ah, I understand now. And it was this monk was in a very simple hut in the north of Thailand. And when you talk about simple, I really mean simple. Just made out of bamboo and thatch for the roof. And thatch for the walls as well. Really simple to put up. Very natural, very easy. And, you know, we go on arms round every morning to the local village, live a very, very frugal, peaceful life, but very, very happy. But living in the jungle, there are such things as storms. And if a storm comes when you're in the middle of a forest and you haven't got much protection, it is very dangerous. Trees come down, or even big branches. And imagine, just visualize a bamboo and thatch hut. If a decent-sized branch hits that roof, it just goes straight through. Not like metal roofs or these roofs which are engineered that are almost like an elephant can fall on this roof and it won't go through. Otherwise we would get planning permission or building permission. Not an elephant would actually fall on this roof, but you never know. So over-engineered for safety. But anyway, so it was such a flimsy dwelling that one branch goes through and it would, if he didn't actually get crushed, he'd get injured, break a leg, break an arm. And remember, this is, you know, simple living. You don't have mobile phones. You don't, you know, if he did have one, there would be no telecommunications tower there. There's no one you can call. No one can help you. If you break your leg, that's probably worse than dying instantly. You just die slowly. So it's very dangerous. So he was up all night hearing a thud, bang, whack. Actually, that hurt. That didn't work as I expected it to. I always say that when you give a public talk, do some special effects. Because you know what happens when people talk, you know, they fall asleep, they get bored. You do something like special, like raise your voice, go bang, or whoa. And then actually, you know, people actually enjoy it for weird ways. Anyway, so bang, whack. All these trees were thudding next to him. And so, you know, it was very difficult to meditate, and he's up all night. But, you know, he survived. If he didn't survive, he wouldn't be able to tell me the tale. He survived the night. And in the morning, he walked outside to see the damage. And yeah, several big trees just missed his hut. He was lucky to be alive. But it wasn't the trees which grabbed his attention. What he saw was the leaves on the forest floor. Most of the leaves which had been torn off the trees and lay dead on the forest floor were the old brown leaves. But amongst those old brown leaves, there were several yellow leaves, even a few green leaves. And some of those green leaves were so freshly green, they could have only been alive for a few hours. And now they lay dead on the forest floor. Before he completed his insight, his understanding, he checked to see what leaves remained alive on the twigs and branches of those trees. And of course, most of the leaves remaining alive on the forest trees were the green leaves. But even though a few green leaves had been torn off and laid dead on the ground, there were still a few curly old brown leaves still clinging on, even though the young green leaves were torn off and laid dead. You understand what we mean. Even though young children die, there are still some of these old people who keep coming to our center every Friday for years and years and years, still clinging on. You know, the old grandma and grandpa. Why aren't they dead yet? They're all still clinging on when these young people die. And he realized that there was nothing wrong. That's what I always say to them. There's something wrong. It can't be right. Why are old people still alive and young people die? It can't be right. But then he saw it. It was right. It was the nature of life and death. It's the nature of a storm which goes through a forest to mostly take the old leaves. But it always leaves a few old leaves. And it always takes a few young green leaves as well. Nothing is wrong. Welcome to life. That's the law of life in which we live. Diseases, accidents, whatever happens, mostly takes the old people first. But a few young people, and a few very young people, a few children as well. That's our life. The nice thing about that little story also, not only is it true, it's a reflection from nature, which we understand when we are still. We can actually see then, we can actually get the connections, as in nature, as in our life. We're not apart from nature, we're part of nature. And from that we can also have a lot of other really great understandings. The main thing I wanted to talk about tonight, which I got onto maybe just almost halfway through the talk already, is actually just, well, young people die, 3 deaths recently, and just, well, what happens afterwards when a person dies? And ever since I was really small, I had no problem in accepting the idea of a reincarnation. One of the reasons why it's got even firmer as a truth is by understanding the nature of the mind. We learn what this mind actually is. We have become such a materialistic society in so many ways that even things like love and kindness, even joy, we think is just something which is a byproduct of a brain. Just to be able to get some happiness and joy by taking some physical stuff, like a drug. And people just sometimes don't believe. When they come to see monks, especially or nuns, we are pretty happy people. And sometimes they come and see and say, well, you know, what drugs are you taking, monks? That happened to me so many times. One time, I was visiting a prison in UK. know, we spend a lot of time in prisons as monks. I often tell people, visiting prisons, I always would keep a log of how many hours and minutes I spent, you know, doing community work in prison, to be used as credit in case I ever got sentenced for something. But look, I've already done about the equivalent of about 2 or 3 months. You should take that off. But anyway, I was inside this jail because it was a ceremony. Somebody has sweet-talked the British government into putting a Buddha statue in the middle of an open prison, a big one. And now, it's very easy for people to sponsor a Buddha statue, especially inside a prison. Wow, that's amazing. And so we did an installation ceremony. And for those of you who ever come and see some of the Buddhist rituals, you know, one of the favorite ones is actually we go around 3 times. Flowers, candles, and incense, we bow around. It's like an act of like worship, reverence. You know, it's interesting that where this comes from, you know, we don't know, but they also do that in Mecca when they go around the, whatever it's called, the Kaaba. Always go 3 times round, wearing white. There's incredible similarities between our different traditions. Where they came from, I don't know, but that's Buddhist. Anyhow, there we were going round 3 times, and I was inspired, I was happy. Amazing, something good being done in a prison, not just locking people up and reinforcing how guilty they should feel, but no, just something which is inspiring. And I was just so happy, with a big smile on my face, much more than I usually have, because more inspiration. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw these 2 prisoners. They just, they've got nothing to do. Nothing was on the TV that night, so they just hang out, seeing what the hell was going on with these crazy people in brown robes and a big Buddha statue. You know, what's going on? What's happening? So they're just, having a quick look. And then I heard them, one looking to me, looking at the other prisoner, and pointed to me. He said, "That monk, he's on the gear." If you don't know what gear means, you know, it's like some sort of drug. Because that's the only thing they could explain the happiness from. Just, some medication. It's not medication. You know, it's meditation, not medication. And you don't need that stuff to be happy and have a really good time. And I tell people, I don't know why people laugh at this, because it's true, I'm a good time monk. I have a good time. And people say a good time girl, a good time boy, and that's other meanings. I'm a good time monk because you're having a good time, you're happy. And so you don't need the medication, there's something else which goes on there. And this is actually where you start to realize that why do people want to be happy with things? Material stuff. We're far too focused on the material stuff. And instead, as those Asian religions, especially Buddhists, we've been focusing on the mind for years and years and years. That's the important part. And so these days, people don't understand what the mind actually is. And still, great scientists have been trying to prove that the mind is some byproduct of the brain, and they have failed miserably for years and years and years and years. And it's about time that they face the truth, and they're barking up the wrong tree, as they say, that the mind is something totally different. Fortunately, there's a few scientists, big ones, who are actually seeing something totally different. One of them you all saw recently, or some of you saw, who came to our global conference on Buddhism, Professor Bernard Carr. I mention him because he's a really close friend. We were at Cambridge together. And Buddhist Society, we chase ghosts together in the Psychic Research Society, chasing ghosts and Buddhists and astronomy as well, and also theoretical physics. And he lessened his interest in Buddhism and went more into theoretical physics. I lessened my interest in theoretical physics and became more of a Buddhist. But he made a wonderful analogy at our conference where he said, we're really close friends, it's great we've come together again. Ajahn Brahm, he went off to be a well-known Buddhist under one of the great teachers, Ajahn Chah. And Bernard, he gave up his Buddhism. He became a close disciple of Stephen Hawking. He told me only recently, I went for lunch with him when I was in Cambridge last October, November. I didn't realize just how close he was to Stephen Hawking. That in that movie, which they did of Stephen Hawking, a brief no, The Theory of Everything, I think they called it. In that movie, one of the characters in there was based on him, based on Bernard. So much so that Bernard got invited to the premiere in London. He actually walked on the red carpet, which he thought was really cool. So they're very close. So he became a disciple of Stephen Hawking. I became a disciple of Ajahn Chah. And now we sort of come together again. And he wants to spend the rest of his time, you know, because he's emeritus now, he's retired. He's a professor of theoretical physics at Queen Mary College in London. So he's a top physicist. To try and reintroduce into science the primacy of the mind. So, what the heck do I mean? What is the mind? And this is a little exercise. When you're giving a talk, don't just talk at people, get them to contribute. I am now going to ask you something. And I want you to put up your left hand or your right hand. You can't keep both hands down unless you're armless. If you've got two hands, put one of them up. And be honest. Not yet. Come on, don't. Be patient. If you are happy, no, more happy than sad, having a reasonably good time, put up your right hand. If you're more miserable, put up your left hand. Okay? Put up your hand. Doesn't matter which one it is. Keep it up. Those people who've got the right hand up, you're happy. Now please point to the happiness for me. Locate it for me. Where is it? Where is it? Point to it. You're all pointed to different places. How come? Your head? Is your head happy? Now you can put it down. This is an exercise because it's so hard to locate happiness. You're not imagining it. In fact, happiness is a real thing. It's tangible. You know it. You experience it many times. Different forms, but it's real. Where is it? Next time you're angry, where is anger? Where is it? Is it in your head? Is it in your tummy? Where is it? The point is that we can't locate these things because these are things which exist in the mind. Just like you locate or define, like a garden. What is a garden? A garden is where you find trees and flowers and lawns. A garden is defined by what exists in it. So if you want to know what the mind is where love, kindness, happiness, anger, anxiety, fear, hope, peace, where all of those flowers and weeds live. That's what defines the mind. So it gives you an understanding of what that mind actually is. It takes it away from being some philosophical, superstitious, well, what actually is it? Where you find those things, those qualities, that is where the mind is. And you will soon figure out it does not live in physical space. It doesn't live in your brain or in your body here. Now, to prove that again, one of Bernard's and my common friends is actually the house where we had lunch together a few weeks ago. Is a guy called Jeff, and one of my other friends from Cambridge, had a lot of time together. I know that when my friend Bernard came here, I think Cecilia, who was here just a few hours ago, she asked him in public, okay, you were a close friend of Ajahn Brahm, tell us all the dirt. What did he really get up to as a student? What was the naughtiest thing he did? Come on, let us know. Now, Bernard doesn't know much, but my friend Jeff does know a lot, so that's why I've never invited him over here. I was just a student like everybody else, did really stupid things. But fortunately, I didn't get caught. But anyway, his daughter, Pascal, she came, she's married and now and got a kid. She came and saw me just in October as well. And when she was at grade 1 primary school, That was when the teacher asked her a question. This is a brilliant story. In philosophy, this is actually where you start with a story, a logical sequence which you end up in a place you never expected to end up. And it changes the way you look at life. And this came from a five-year-old kid who later on went to do her postgraduate research in Oxford in biochemistry. So she's obviously just a really gifted kid. But at 5 years of age, her teacher, grade one at school, asked a question. What is the biggest thing in the world? That was the question. And one kid put a hand up. He wrote to me about this, and this is actually what happened. My daddy, a five-year-old kid. You know, for a five-year-old kid, daddy is huge. And some other kids said, no, miss, an elephant. They've just been to the zoo. Elephant's much bigger than anybody's daddy. No, miss, a mountain is much bigger than an elephant. Actually, you're getting somewhere. This is the whole point of the exercise, getting the kids to actually to think and to imagine and to know more. And then Pascal put her hand up and said, no, miss, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. And at that, even the teacher didn't understand what the heck she meant. What do you mean, your eye? And then this five-year-old genius said, well, miss, my eye can see her daddy. My eye can see an elephant and a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye, my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. That is genius. It's genius because it sees things in a different perspective than other people think. And you can't fault it. It's just seeing things from a different angle. And now you know what's the biggest thing. Your eye. Because everything you see can fit into it. It's huge. But I wrote back immediately and I said, 9 out of 10, but not 10 out of 10. Because your mind can see everything your eye can see and many other stuff you can't see with your eye. Imaginary things. Flying pigs. Striped elephants. You can imagine all of that sort of stuff. You'll never see that. And your mind can also hear stuff. Real and imaginary sounds. It can smell, it can know tastes, it can feel feelings in the body, even like phantom limbs sometimes, real and imaginary sensations. It's also got its own area. You know, the love, the kindness, the fear. In fact, I argued, everything you can ever experience and know in life can fit into your mind. So, your mind is the biggest thing. Not in the world, because you can know the world and that can fit into your mind. Your mind is even bigger than the world. Now that is a logical argument which I've never had any philosopher manage to tear apart and deny. It's just looking at life in a different perspective and coming up with an incredible answer about how huge and powerful your human mind is. Which is why people continue to report to me weird and strange things. Mind games and stuff. Now you know I told a story a long time ago and people said, yeah, that's true, but they didn't actually believe it. But I heard it from the source, and the source swore to me. I asked him again and again, yes, it happened. The guy who was an Anagarika for 1 year at Serpentine Monastery went over to Germany to complete his degree. First day at a university campus, he walked past the ATM machine. This is a great story. And you may actually get some benefit from this if you understand it and practice it properly. So he walked past the ATM machine and he said the ATM machine emitted a sound. He called it a gurgling type sound. Very difficult to define, but it made a sound just as he passed by. And he took that as a welcome from the ATM machine to the campus. And so from that time on, that was his ATM machine. That's where he did all his transactions. And because he'd been trained by a monk like me, a little bit weird and crazy, but he would always give loving kindness to the ATM machine. May you be happy and well. May you never run out of cash. May your clients never hit you and swear at you when they find they've got no balance. May no robbers never tear you out of a wall with a four-wheel drive or blow you up trying to get the cash. May you live at peace and happy. That sort of stuff. He talked to the ATM, regarded it as a personal being with consciousness, was always kind to it. And he swore to me, this actually happened. Having his lunch one afternoon on a bench, maybe about 5 or 10 meters away from the ATM. No one had gone close to that ATM machine for about 20 minutes. He was there, he saw it. No one had gone close to it. And he was sitting there having his lunch, and he heard the gurgling sound again. The machine gurgled at him, and he looked around, and he saw a 20 euro note come out of the machine. No one had put in any credit card, punched in any numbers for 20 minutes. He got 20 euros. And he went to the machine with disbelief, but it was there. And he pulled it out. He went, "It doesn't belong to anybody." No one claimed it. Of course they wouldn't claim it, because it was the ATM's gift to his friend. Do you believe that? That actually happened. People say it couldn't happen, therefore it didn't. But that's not the case. Any scientists know it did happen. It was there, it was real. Just we haven't figured out how that happens yet. It's the way that mind works. And somebody was telling me that. The reason I got this story, one very strong supporter was telling me that his old iPhone was not working. You know, sometimes your mobile phones, you use them so much and they get a bit past it, but he was trying to live a simple life, so instead of replacing and getting a new one, he kept the old one. And when it wasn't working, he banged it, he hit it. And of course, it still didn't work. And then he realized, I'm a Buddhist, that's not the way it should do things. So he apologized to his iPhone. "I'm sorry, iPhone, I should not have hit you. I really apologize. I will never do that again. I wish you all peace and happiness." And he said, it started working immediately. It did. I've tried that before, not with iPhones. I don't have an iPhone, but I've tried that so many times. I saw her earlier, Ronnie, is she here, Veronica? She's over that man back there somewhere. They were trying to open their car. I came back from a ceremony, and I was just walking down the road here on a Saturday afternoon, and the Kalyanamitta group, they were about to go out, kite surfing, doing something weird. And anyway, the boot of their car was locked tight, and they could not open it. And they were trying for about 20 minutes. Oh, over there, there you are. How long were you trying to open up that car before I came along? Only 5 or 10 minutes, yeah. How many people tried? Only two of us. But you couldn't do it? Yeah, there we go. Looks like we opened it, okay. So I came along, and they said, "Ajahn Pram, please could you use your powers to open the car?" So I'm always a very kind monk and very helpful. And so I said, okay, but on condition. I wanted to make a deal. The deal was that Ronnie at the back there would become a nun. And she said yes, never ever imagining I could do it. But of course, that's what you do. You give it loving kindness. Nice car. That was what I did. Nice car. And I put the key in, and I turned it, and it opened straight away. And poor old Roddy has to become a nun now. be careful playing around with monks. It's very dangerous. But fortunately, that one of the other youth group members was a lawyer. She saw the loophole straight away, which is why everybody doesn't have to become a nun yet. She said, "You never mention the time. Maybe in 50 years or her next life sometime." And she promises, yes, she will become a nun, but didn't say when. That was a loophole. But it's amazing what you can do with the mind. And this is something which we've seen for such a long time. The mind is huge. And I spent most of my life as a monk investigating that, getting to know it, what it's really like, how powerful it is. And it is enormously powerful. And as a scientist, you wish you could take that evidence out there and show it to people. So we realize that this mind is incredibly powerful, and this is actually what we should be doing in our modern world. So strengthening the mind, not our brain, not learning how to think, but learning how to be still and accessing much more of the power which we've lost now with our mind. And it's incredible what it can do. So because of that, it's always been the case in Buddhism, focusing on the mind, learning what your mind is like. The exercise which we do is meditation. That's how you really strengthen the mind, get to know it. Similarly to end up with now, because I'm going over time again. Sometimes the only way you can convey these truths is through similes. And very hard to find similes, but this is one of the simile which I used, the simile of the emperor. So once there was an emperor, but every time the emperor came out in public, the emperor was always covered head to toe with 5 pieces of clothing, with boots that went right up to the thighs, with his trousers which went way over the top of the boots to the ankles, and really high up his, it wasn't his, I don't know who it was, the chest. And a big jacket which overlapped the top of the trousers, went right up to the neck and right down to the arms. Huge gloves which overlapped the sleeves of the tunic, and a helmet, like Darth Vader or something, which overlapped the top of the tunic. So you could not see any part of the skin or the eyes or the face of this emperor. You didn't know who the emperor was. What is it, a girl or a boy? Old or young? Asian, Caucasian, African, or whatever? You couldn't see the body at all. All you could see was the coverings, the 5 coverings. The helmet, the jacket, the gloves, the trousers, and the boots. So no one really understood this powerful emperor who it was. And the only way you can find out is to take off those 5 pieces of clothing to find out what's underneath. And in that simile, this is the 5 senses: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. Your mind, the emperor, and it is the emperor, controls so much of what you do in life. Your happiness, your sadness, your ability to love and be loved, your physical health, your peace, it's all this emperor inside. We don't know what it is, nor who we are. So, we take off those 5 pieces of clothing: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touch. That's what happens in meditation. Close your eyes, sight vanishes. Really still, you can't hear anything. Can't smell, as long as no one farts. Disappears. That is why in Buddhist temples they would light lots of incense. Just in case. Master smell. There's always reasons for this. You're not tasting anything, and because you're sitting perfectly still and just watching your breath, soon your body vanishes. Can't feel the feet, can't feel your hands, no aches and pains anywhere, the body disappears, and your breath disappears. Then you go
The last of those five senses has vanished, and the only thing left is your mind, the sixth sense. That's what happens in meditation. That's what you're doing this for. You carry on like this, and soon everything on those five senses vanishes. Your girliness, your Sri Lankan-ness, your Englishness, that's all outside in the body. Being old, being young, that's body stuff. When all that vanishes, you find out who this emperor is inside, for yourself. Not theory, not believing somebody else, your own direct experience. And that is what meditation does. You find out, what is this mind? And it will blow. Actually, how can knowing the mind blow your mind? But you know what blowing the mind means. It just really amaze you, just how powerful is this mind. That's what the monks and nuns do. Spend so much time, then the body vanish and disappear. See these beautiful lights in the mind. Incredible bliss and power. There for you. Understanding. This mind is much more powerful than this body. Little driver gets into this body for a lifetime and afterwards goes and gets another body. Or just goes to incredible other places where that mind can live for long periods of time. And how this mind creates time and creates stuff. If you want to know who the creator is, it's not some god in the sky. You are the creator. This mind. Once you know that, you know just how you can get 20 euros out of an ATM. Very useful skills in today's economy. Thank you for listening. Very good. Okay, let's get some of the questions, especially from overseas. Here we go.
From the Netherlands and from Germany and somewhere else.
Since a while my meditations end in the mindfulness stage. I lean back, relax and slowly notice how agitated I actually am. It gets worse during meditation, so I have to stop. What to do? Follow the instructions which I give. So if you start by especially paying attention to the peace-o-meter, then you'll find when the peace-o-meter gets more and more still, then you're actually looking at what's really important, so you de-agitate yourself. So sometimes it's because the mindfulness is not put in the right place. You're not really seeing what the problem is. And if you put the mind on the peace-o-meter, as I mentioned here, it'll probably be solved. Next question, letting go. Are these two words overused these days? People seem to be careless users for anything they cannot get or do not want to put effort into. Exactly. You go to work and instead of people saying you're fired or we sack you, they say we have to let you go. They don't have to let you go. You're sacking me. But it is overused and sometimes people complain, well, if we just let go, we get nowhere in life. Exactly. There is a time for letting go and a time for doing stuff. So, if you need to go to the toilet, do not let go in this room. You put effort to get to the toilet first, and then you let go. Do not let go when you're riding on the back of a motorbike going home. Cling and be attached. So letting go is a skill which we use when it's appropriate. When there's nothing to do, then we let it be. When there's something to do, we put effort in. But the point is, we know how to put effort into our lives. We've been doing that ever since we went to school. But we haven't learned how to be still and let things be, which is one of the reasons we're a crazy society. So let go, great. Learn how to do that. A skill which you can use whenever it's necessary. When it's nothing to do, do nothing. Let go. How many times is it
There's nothing to do, but we still have to do something because we don't know how to let go. Lastly, from Journey, what is transcendent mind? Is it what remains to us after death? Transcendent mind, I don't know. I know that one of our monks many years ago, he had a bad teeth. We live in Serpentine, it's a long way to go to the dentist. I mean, and you know what it's like these days, you have to make an appointment. And then when you go to the appointment, then you have to wait, and then it's just such a pain in the... Actually, probably the pain in the neck is worse than the pain in the mouth to go to the dentist sometimes. So this monk decided, it's a waste of time going to the dentist. So he decided to pull his own tooth out. I saw him. He went to the workshop, got a pair of pliers, and just yanked his tooth out. And I just happened to be going to the workshop at Bodhidharma Monastery, and I saw this bloody tooth, in a pair of pliers. And what you just be doing, I took my tooth out. It's much cheaper and much quicker than going to the dentist. And I thought, how do you do that? And he said, it's very easy. He said, because, and it's a wonderful little teaching. He said, when I decided to pull my tooth out, that didn't hurt. Thinking about planning doesn't hurt. And when I went to the workshop, that didn't hurt. When I picked up the pliers, that didn't hurt. When I put the pair of pliers on the tooth, that never hurt. When I wiggled it, that hurt. But, just for maybe 20 seconds, 30 seconds, and it was out. And it didn't hurt much afterwards. It's only 20 seconds of pain, that's all. But if that was you, even before you'd even picked up the pliers, it would hurt like hell. You see what pain is? Anticipation. He trained himself not to anticipate being in the present moment, so there's only 10 seconds of pain. So that is what we call how to transcendental meditation. And that's enough for tonight. Thank you so much. Okay, let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha. I apologize for that, but those of you who know me know what to expect.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.
I enjoyed that. Yeah,
it's good. And then, Ram, do you know when Sido's ordination is?
Wednesday.
This Wednesday?
Yeah.
Yeah, 11.
Yeah, 11
for the first.
Hi.